Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It is 7:10 in the Twin Cities, 51 degrees. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock, along with producer Jonathan Lowe. Well, this past week, I covered an announcement by the city of Minneapolis saying that they were going to change how they handled their investigations of sexual assaults. And one of the speakers at that news conference was a woman who is a forensic nurse. And forensic nurses are the ones who do the examinations of victims. What their job is so important because they are there with the victims. I wasn't aware how long some of these examinations can take. They can take 4 hours, even longer, while they go over and photograph and talk to the victim. They play a critical, critical role. And one of the things that I also heard here is how long it can take for officers to respond to a victim who is in a hospital who wishes to report a sex crime. And that's something that I did not realize was the case, that oftentimes officers will say, listen, the victim is in a safe place, obviously a hospital. We have a shooting to respond to. So oftentimes those victims are left waiting. It was really an important discussion because there's been a lot of talk. The Star Tribune did really a wonderful job last year talking about how many, many sex crimes are not fully investigated and how there needs to be a more victim-centric process in those initial hours of gathering the information and gathering the statements from the victim and from potential witnesses. Amy Schmitz is a lead nurse with the Allina Forensic Nursing Program, and she is joining us right now. Amy, thank you so much for coming on.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Amy, let me ask you, and obviously we know our nurses are so amazing. They go through so much training, so much education. But what does it take? I mean, this really sounds like such a skilled, such an important job. What kind of training do you have to go through? And this has got to be one of the toughest jobs in nursing.
Well, I've probably done over 500 exams. So I started, first of all, the nurses that work for my program, they're registered nurses that come to us with some kind of emergency nursing experience, obstetrics and GYN, mental health and chemical dependency. We require one of those, or ICU nursing. My background's in emergency and ICU. So the training we put all these nurses through is a 40-hour course, a week long, that teaches our nurses how to handle these patients in evidence collection, most importantly, the medical exam, the medical part of it in the head-to-toe examination. And, for example, victims of strangulation, 50% of those victims don't have any injuries.
Wow.
So you really have to triage your patient and look at your patient from head to toe, making sure that they're okay. The evidence collection is a large part of it, but also very small, where the medical is most important. But we teach our nurses all that within a week, but then they're also out with us in the field for, it depends, 2 to 4 months, you know.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. If you have experience, it's probably 2 months, but 3 to 4 for new nurses.
And you folks really are on the front lines. What are some of the things that you believe need to be changed? And do you feel some of the changes that are being addressed by the post board recommendations, by the Minnesota Attorney General's recommendation, by the city of Minneapolis and the police department? What are some of your thoughts about that?
Well, since the topic of the sexual assault patients and that kind of thing has become so big the past couple years, I feel like over the last 2 to 3 years, I feel like the police has incorporated victim-informed, it's called FETI. So it's like trauma-informed interviewing. And I believe that they've been incorporating this into their training the past 2 to 3 years, which I've seen a dramatic change in the officers and how they respond.
Really?
And things like that. Yes. Yes, there is times that we have to wait, but I mean, it's all, you know, we're trying to do so much work with what we have.
Right.
And that's what we're striving for, is more.
You know, one of the things that they talked about at that news conference was that training officers in trauma-based investigations, in other words, training them on how to interview somebody who has been through such a traumatic event. And I can't imagine anything more traumatic. And that you have to get that training because that helps you deal with questioning that person. And they may not be able to kind of go through it in steps 1, 2, 3 chronologically. They may have flashbacks, that kind of thing. How important is that, do you think?
I think it's very important. You know, when we use the same mechanism, but it's all about when you walk in the room and the rapport that you develop with the victim, and then you can, you know, you can kind of see where you're going or how they react, and then that kind of guides you along with your exam and what questions you ask next,
right?
And things like that. It it's hard to explain, but you know, it's about how you ask and how your rapport with the patient.
Right. It sounds like you're saying is that somebody who is on the front line, such as yourself, and we're chatting with Amy Schmidt. She is a forensic nurse with Allina Health Systems, and she is the one who does the exams on people who are victims of sexual assault. It sounds like you're saying that the changes are already happening even before this new policy was announced, that officers are really getting it and changing their approach.
Yeah, they're really trying. They are. Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's very difficult. In terms of what you do, do you feel that you as nurses have enough resources? Are there enough of you that do this important work?
So the challenge is getting, so recently in the metro area, there's more than one program. So at Allina, we have our manager, Kareen Zakwazinski, and then there's I. So she's full-time, and I work 4 days a week. And so we really strive for the full-time forensic nurses to be able to accommodate all patients. But we recently added 2 nurses on call during the weekends because of the call volume. So I do think we have adequate resources, but you know, all our numbers keep increasing. So at some point, we're going to have to increase our staffing. One unique thing at Allina Health is we are the only program in the state of Minnesota that's a full forensic nursing program.
So wow. Okay.
We not only do sexual assault, we incorporate domestic violence, child abuse, elder abuse, and some general assaults.
Got it. Well, listen, Amy Schmitz, an Allina forensic nurse, thank you so much for joining us. We certainly appreciate your time this evening.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having me.
All right. We're going to continue this conversation, and thank you to Amy Schmitz for joining us with Christy Jarvis. She was a forensic program coordinator of HART. That's the Hennepin Assault Response Team, and she is also a forensic nurse examiner. I'm going to follow up with her from a coordinating standpoint if she feels the resources are adequate. And what about these changes that have been announced? Will they bring an improvement to the response to sexual assaults in Hennepin County and even on a larger scope throughout the state? You're listening to News Talk 830 WCCO. It is 7:22 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock, along with producer Jonathan Lowe. We are talking about changes in the handling of sexual assaults. The Minneapolis police and the city of Minneapolis announced changes in their protocols this past week. and also the Post Board, which governs all police departments, set out different protocols earlier this year. The Minnesota Attorney General's office ordered some changes and made recommendations on how to improve the system. We just heard from Amy Schmitz. She is a forensic nurse with Allina. Now we've got Christy Jarvis. She is with, she's a forensic program coordinator of HART, Hennepin Assault Response Team, and she is also a forensic nurse examiner. Christy, thank you so much for coming on. We certainly appreciate your time this evening.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
All right. Let me ask you, do you think these changes are enough, and are you seeing them in your practice?
I do think there. I think it's a good start, and I think that, you know, overall we can always improve on our response, but I think this is a great way to get started with that. I have seen changes already with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. We actually have a group of us that are called the Sexual Assault Initiative, and we get together routinely to discuss cases and our processes overall to help determine where we can still improve. And we partner very closely with Minneapolis Police, as well as the other police departments within Hennepin County and outside Hennepin County. And I've already seen a lot of changes just in the way that these cases are being handled.
Well, that's great. And the changes overall, specifically, how about in terms of the officers and the response time to getting to the hospital? Because many people, you know, there are many victims who go directly to a hospital because they're so traumatized and prefer to deal with get the help from you. And then you're the ones that actually make the call to the police. Do you find that police departments are responding quickly enough when you call 911?
Absolutely, Esme. We don't see much of a delay. Again, about half of the cases that we have are at HCMC, which might help with that response. But even when we're outside of Hennepin County, providing exams down in Burnsville and Northfield, the response from law enforcement is quite good.
In terms of the training that you get and the work that's being done to try and make sure that the interviews with these victims are done in a way that is conducive to getting the most information that you can out of them. And while that sounds sort of obvious, apparently when you have somebody who's been a victim of such devastating trauma, you can't just interview them the way you might interview somebody whose home has been burglarized. Do you feel that those changes are being heard and being implemented? And do you feel that they're necessary?
Yeah, so I mean, so as Maya said, that's a great question. We actually focus a lot on that when we do our training of nurses who are going through classes to learn how to be a forensic nurse, and we refer to it as trauma-informed care. And I think it is important because when somebody goes through a traumatic experience, the number of stress hormones that go through their body basically shut their brain down. And they aren't able to remember things the way you would, say, if you were just, you know, going to work one day and you could remember every step from start to finish.
Right.
Their brains don't think that way. So it's very important for anybody who works with these individuals to be trained in that so that they know how to ask them questions to get the most information from them.
Right.
We do it. I do train at the Minneapolis Police Academy as well. And I think that there's a lot of different law enforcement departments that are training their officers and their detectives in this so that they can be able to better communicate with those victims.
Yeah, and I had never heard that term before this past week. Trauma-informed training is what it's called. And in Minneapolis, at the Minneapolis Police Department, Chief Arredondo, the chief of the entire department, said everyone in the department, including himself, was getting this training because he felt it was so important for people to understand this. How long has this been around?
Well, I was trained on it a couple of years ago at one of our international conferences by a woman by the name of Rebecca Campbell. And that was my first exposure to it. So I don't know, you know, honestly, how long it's been around. I think with forensic nursing in general, it's such a new field that things are always being developed and changes are happening. And I think that's where it started to come from, was the area of forensic nursing first.
Yeah. Oh, and that's interesting because I did ask our first guest, Amy Schmitz, about the training and how much training was needed. But you're saying this is actually a new field.
Forensic nursing is, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Hennepin program actually started it back in one of the first programs in the U.S., but forensic nursing in general is fairly new. Our governing body that we call the International Association of Forensic Nurses was just formed in 1992.
Oh, interesting. And more, is it something that a lot of men and women who are going into nursing are considering?
No, because most people don't know about it. Huh. So in nursing school, we were never told that this was even an option. Right. I found it when I started looking into different areas of nursing, and I fell in love with it. But yeah, a lot of times we are now speaking to colleges more about this so that nurses know this is an option. But I think in Minnesota, we have probably less than 70 practicing forensic nurses.
Wow. Okay. And is this being taught at local nursing schools?
No, it is actually something that is done outside of nursing
okay.
school after nurses have graduated and they start their career. And then this is something that they can do after like 1 to 2 years of experience.
Wow. Okay. That's fascinating because I didn't realize that it was a new field and I didn't realize, you know, the degree of specialization that it involves. Well, listen, Laura Dunham, thank you so much. Or I'm sorry, Christy Jarvis, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate this insight into, you know, the training that goes on and how these changes that everybody agrees are needed are being implemented. We thank you for that. And we certainly hope that in this important field, these improvements and these changes are implemented to try and make the reporting of these horrible crimes as easy and as accurate as possible. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Again.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
All right. That is Christy Jarvik, Forensic Program Coordinator of the Hennepin Assault Response Team and also a Forensic Nurse Examiner. All right, folks, we are going to take a break. We're going to give you some weather. I hate to tell you, the S word is in the forecast on multiple days. Yes, we're talking a chance of snow. I'll give you the details here in just a few minutes. And then coming up in our next half hour, we are going to talk about two different topics. One, a really, really cool contest at St. Thomas for entrepreneurship, and also the threat of measles and how it is a growing threat in this day and age. Despite vaccinations, a lot of people choosing not to get vaccinated, and what that means for the growth of measles in this country. So keep it here. It is 7:36 in the Twin Cities, 51 degrees. Esme Murphy with you, along with studio coordinator and producer Jonathan Lowe, until 9 o'clock. Have you ever thought, or have you ever had a great idea and wondered, gosh, I just think maybe this could be something that could be just a great company or a great business? Well, at the University of St. Thomas, at the Schill School of Entrepreneurship, they have a contest, and this is featuring students from around the country that have entered, and it's down to, I think, 25 finalists from all over the nation, and it's at the Schill School of Entrepreneurship in St. Thomas, and they are competing for $250,000 in prizes. To see who's got some of the best ideas, and this kind of money could go to seed money for some of these brilliant ideas. Joining us is Laura Dunham. She is the Associate Dean of the Schill School of Entrepreneurship at the University of St. Thomas. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Well, this sounds so cool. Obviously, the Schill School, a great, great business school, but this is a really neat contest. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so we are hosting this weekend, starting on Thursday, a 3-day celebration of undergraduate entrepreneurship that culminates on Saturday with a national business plan competition. And as you mentioned, we're bringing in 25 teams from all around the country, and they were selected from over 100 submissions. And these teams are going to participate in 3 days of just all kinds of activities, workshops, pitch competition, an innovation challenge where they get put with members of other teams to solve an innovation problem, and then on Saturday, the big national competition. So it's a pretty exciting event and a lot of fun and a lot of great learning that goes on.
Right. And some amazing prizes. I mean, the top prize is $75,000.
Right.
And there's $250,000 in total prizes. Obviously, one of the big issues for people who've got those great ideas is you need the capital in terms of trying to get it off the ground. And this is exactly what that could achieve. How did this idea come to be?
So this is an idea that is brought courtesy of the Richard M. Schultz Family Foundation and also EIX. EIX is an online portal for educators and entrepreneurs sharing information. And the idea was, let's figure out ways that we can continue to support all these young people who are entrepreneurial out there in the world and who need venues to continue to build their skills, but also to network, to get mentored, and to have the opportunity to earn this kind of capital. And these students are amazing. They're tackling big problems. It's a variety of different problems. They're bringing some really innovative solutions to these problems. And it's exciting to be able to give them a venue to share these ideas, to learn from investors and advisors and judges how to improve their ideas, and then to be able to provide them with the seed capital they need.
Right. And it's the largest undergraduate-only venture pitch competition in North America in terms of cash prizes. It also, I would imagine, because it applies to anybody from all these colleges can apply, I would think it also sort of raises the profile of the Schultz School.
Well, I think for sure it does. I think the Schultz School is one of the first entrepreneurship programs in the country. So we've always been well known. We were one of the first schools to actually have a dedicated department with faculty who have been entrepreneurs and have been trained, you know, PhDs as entrepreneurs. So St. Thomas has always had a major commitment to entrepreneurial education, and this is just one of the many things that we do at St. Thomas that allows us to, you know, further the education of the students that we work with.
And what are some of the ideas that are out there that have to be considered and that some of these students have come up with?
Yeah, so these students are just tackling just a huge range of things, from medical issues to social problems. Here's a couple of the ideas that are going to be among the semi-finalists this week. An intelligent steering wheel that helps prevent distracted driving. An automatic intravenous injection device for medication that replaces manual needle injections that actually have very high error and infection rates. A personal carbon emission tracker and an offsetting app that also contributes to reforestation projects. A platform for people with intellectual disabilities to discover and share their artistic talents.
Wow.
A safer and more, yeah, I mean, the list goes on and on. I mean, they're all entirely different. And all of them really innovative in the way they're trying to solve this problem. It's very impressive to see what these young people are doing.
And let me ask you, obviously they're going to be judged on the merits of the project they're proposing, but it also sounds that the way they pitch it is going to be evaluated. Is that the case?
Yes. So there's 9 criteria that the judges are looking at. And most of it has to do with the business idea itself. You know, have they really identified a customer who has a real problem? Does their solution address that problem? Have they figured out their competitive advantage? Do they have a revenue model that, you know, have they figured out how they're going to get paid for it? Is there a substantial opportunity there? But part of it is how well they have communicated the idea, how persuasive, how clear, how compelling it is. And you can actually, on the EIX website, you can actually see some of the semifinalists' video pitches that run from 5 to 7 minutes. And you can already see just the tremendous talent that we are going to get to watch on Saturday from looking at their video.
Yeah, and you know, when I first thought about that and how that they're going to be evaluated on the pitches, I thought, well, is that really the way to go? And then I thought, well, you know something? You could have this great idea, but if you can't really articulate it and sell it to get the kind of investment and the capital and people behind it, it's not going to fly. So that is that important, and that might be something that for some people they may be brilliant at putting together this project, but they also have to push themselves to be able to articulate it and sell that. And that's something that I imagine is for some of these people might be the most challenging part.
For sure. I mean, you have to be able to pitch your idea, because what you start with as an entrepreneur is an idea in your head, right?
Right, right.
And an insight. So you have to be able to paint that picture and convince people there is an opportunity there and that your solution is the right one and you're the right person to deliver it. And that's challenging. And it's a really important skill set for any entrepreneur.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of courage involved in being an entrepreneur, and there's also a lot of teamwork. So sometimes you have people who are brilliant, technically brilliant, you know, business, from a business standpoint, and then you have the one who's the great pitcher, you know,
yes.
the person that can do the pitch. So it's all about pulling together the combined skills that you need to bring this thing to market. And pitching is definitely one of those.
All right. And this is going on all this week, and it culminates on Saturday. Is that right?
It does. And it's 1 o'clock is the what we call the championship round. So the final five will be competing. And that is open to the public in Schultz Hall on our Minneapolis campus. Some great judges, Dick Schultz, who is a big supporter of the program at St. Thomas, and obviously founder of Best Buy, very smart entrepreneur. He's one of the judges.
A good person to learn. I mean, no one better to learn from.
Absolutely. Hubert Joly, who's the current CEO of Best Buy, will be a judge. Anne Winblad, big VC from California. And so not only do you get to see these students pitch their ideas, but you get to hear the give and take with the judges, how they're evaluating,
Very cool.
How they're thinking about these ideas. So it's a fantastic learning experience for the audience as well.
How cool. All right. Well, listen, Laura Dunham, Associate Dean, the University of St. Thomas, the Schultz School of Entrepreneurship. I'm sure it's going to be a huge success. Thanks so much for sharing. It's very, very cool.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care. All right. Very neat stuff. Again, culminating on Saturday at the Schultz School of Entrepreneurship at the University of St. Thomas. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about why there has been this outgrowth of measles across the country. We're going to chat with Lynn Bata. She is an immunization clinical consultant with the Minnesota Department of Health. It is 7:49 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with producer Jonathan Lowe, with you until 9 o'clock. Coming up in our 8 o'clock hour, we are going to chat politics and the latest on the Joe Biden controversy with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. But right now, we are going to talk about why measles is surging across the country, why cases of measles are growing across the country. Lynn Bata is an immunization clinical consultant with the Vaccine Preventable Disease Section of the Minnesota Department of Health, and she is joining us right now. Lynn, thank you so much for coming on. And from your perspective, how alarming is this increase in measles across the country?
Well, it certainly is a signal that we still have work to do to keep our children protected. I think that it's a signal that there are pockets of unvaccinated children, and with those pockets come vulnerabilities.
How are we doing here in Minnesota when it comes to measles?
Well, we generally, our rates are pretty high for when we look at a broad measurement of measles vaccination coverage.
So in other words, we don't have a lot of measles here, the disease.
No, despite the outbreak that we saw a couple years ago, we average about 2 cases of measles every year. And usually it comes from people who may have traveled and are unvaccinated and then come home and end up with the disease because they were exposed outside of the U.S. in an area where measles is ongoing.
Right.
And we do see that happening all over the world. There have been some very large outbreaks in Europe. Again, the biggest threat to measles has been people refusing to vaccinate their children. And so there's been some very large outbreaks and ongoing disease in Europe, in Africa, in Asia, Southeast Asia. So
yeah. You know, I have the opportunity to cover the Minnesota State Capitol, and I was there a number of weeks ago, and there was a bill. It's gone nowhere, there was a bill to make it tougher for families or people to opt out of getting their kids vaccinated. And as I said, the bill wasn't even ready to go up for a committee, but there was a protest against the bill. In other words, anti-vaxxers were protesting this bill. And there were hundreds and hundreds of people there with their children, you know, protesting, saying they want the right to not vaccinate their kids. And there were a lot of people there who felt very strongly about this. And, you know, they said that they want the choice. And I'm wondering, is this movement growing?
I would say what we see in Minnesota is that about 2% of the population refuses all vaccines. And that's according to reports that we see from the kindergarten requirement data that comes into the health department. And that's been pretty stable. We really haven't seen it go above that. Where we sometimes see some issues is in pockets in certain areas of the state or certain schools where parents collectively have not been vaccinating. And that's where that creates vulnerabilities. I would say that we're not seeing growing numbers, but certainly social media has created a network that becomes a lot more visible. And so I think we're seeing the visibility of this.
Right. And this is actually, it's interesting that you bring that up, because this protest was actually coordinated through Facebook. Oftentimes, you know, us in the mainstream media will get a news release saying such and such a group is having a news conference, and obviously, or a protest, because they generally want coverage if they're having a protest. This was all coordinated through social media, and that's the way that these groups of anti-vaxxers were communicating. Let me ask you this, and if you can state it again, what does the overwhelming consensus from the medical field say about the safety of vaccines and the importance of vaccines?
You know, the overwhelming evidence shows that they are safe and they are effective. And the overwhelming majority of parents support vaccination. Sometimes they get behind on getting their kids vaccinated, but what we see through our data is that parents do support immunizations. And we have a way to prevent maiming and death in children, and that's through vaccination. And we give vaccines to healthy individuals, both children and adolescents and adults and seniors. We want to make sure that what we're giving is the safest piece of protection that we can provide. And so there is every reason to make sure that what we're providing is safe and that it does work. And while nothing is 100%, the standards that vaccines are held to are extremely high.
Right. And you know, every single person that I've talked to about it, you know, in the medical profession that you know, talks about this data, that has children, all have their children vaccinated. And I don't think there's any more compelling evidence than that, because I think anybody who has children, you will do anything, you know, for your kids to make their lives better and to keep them from suffering or keep them from getting ill. It's just what you do. And the people who are the most knowledgeable are the ones that are advocating for this. Is there enough education out there happening, do you think, or do you think we need to go to a different level in terms of spreading the word about the efficacy of vaccines?
Well, I think that we all have to play a role, you know, as a community, just as we vaccinate to protect not only our children, but others' children as well. We need to be more bold in saying, you know, I vaccinated and my kid is doing great and they're protected. It's a role not only of public health, but it's a role of our provider community, and it's a role of parents. to say, yes, I'm doing the best thing I can by vaccinating my child.
Right. And some of these illnesses can be fatal.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, listen, we do have to cut you off. Lynn Botta, the immunization clinical consultant with the Minnesota Department of Health, thank you so much for helping spread this important message.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Esme.
Absolutely. All right. Something that's so important. All right, folks, keep it here. News Talk 830 coming up. Professor David Schultz of Hamline University on politics.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.